Genesis 1, the first talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on February 20, 2000 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The last time I taught out of Isaiah. I had worked my way to chapter 14 of Isaiah, and I'm going to stop there. I do intend to finish it at some point in time, but I need to get smarter first. So hopefully. So we'll wait and come back to that. But in the meantime, I want to turn to Genesis, something that I'm more experienced with. The only problem with turning to Genesis is it starts with the first chapter. Chapter 1 of Genesis is difficult. I went to the NCC library this last week, and I pulled out all of the commentaries and stacked them up on the table and read through them, and every one of them interprets the first chapter significantly differently than the others. So I feel like I can come to my own conclusions, and I don't have to agree with any of them. But it is very difficult. It poses many challenges interpretively. And one of the reasons is because much of the Bible you're able to draw upon human experience to help you to interpret what's going on. And in Genesis chapter 1, when we're talking about creation, our experience of that is limited. There's so many things that could have been. It's hard to know what was and what's being described there. But we'll work our way through it, and I want to work through chapter 1 today, and then next week I want to come back and talk about a couple of special issues that the passage raises. Chapter 1 is particularly difficult in our time, I think, because of the debate that has occurred between the evolutionists and the creationists. And it's very difficult to look at Genesis chapter 1 without having that debate in the back of your mind and wishing that Genesis chapter 1 would resolve all of that and would be proof positive of a perspective. But that's a lot of burden to put on something that was written over 3,000 years ago. But it's unlikely that was an issue that was in the back of Moses' mind when it was written. So I think we need to step back and try to look at this through fresh eyes without demanding that it answer our question and to figure out what questions it does indeed answer. I think the most helpful issue to resolve in starting on this chapter is, why is it here? What purpose does it serve? Think of it this way. I am thinking of a 10-letter word. Tell me what the first letter is. What are your options? There are quite a few, probably all of them. Now, what if I gave you the last 9 letters? Would that make it easier? Considerably. It would eliminate a lot of the possibilities. Genesis is a piece. The book of Genesis is making some kind of argument. It's making some kind of claim. It's developing some themes. If we know what all of the rest of the chapters of Genesis are talking about, it should help us figure out what the first chapter of Genesis is talking about, because it has to answer some questions. It has to lay some groundwork that the rest of Genesis is then developing. So I'd like to take that approach of looking at chapter 1. What is Genesis doing, and what needs to be laid as groundwork in that first chapter? Genesis is an explanation of the development of mankind. It's a very cursory survey of the history of mankind up until the time of the patriarchs. And what we see in this very cursory survey is that man turns out to be very wicked. And it turns out that his wickedness is very deep. It's a wickedness, it's a rebelliousness against God that is very deep, and it is very widespread. It is spread throughout all of mankind. And there's a sense in which this hatred or resentment against God comes as a bit of a surprise and a disappointment. We see that particularly in the flood narrative. That man was made with greater potential than this. However, we also see in Genesis God's persistence in trying to break through that and find a way to make contact with man and to gain from man the obedience that ought to have been there from the beginning. So we see God reaching out in particular to Abraham and his descendants, and he blesses them both materially and spiritually. And in so doing, he fosters a faith and obedience that was not there otherwise. Okay, so that's the story that we see in broad terms. That's the story that we see developed in Genesis. At the very least, then, what we should be seeing right from chapter 1 is God and his power and his goodness. And we should see man with his limitations and his potentials. Now, the story of origins is always important in talking about anything. In Gutenberg, in the curriculum, we read Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau all wrote about government. And they all write about a time when mankind came together and first formed government. And government was first formed on the basis of a contract that mankind made with himself. They all describe a different contract, but they all describe the same history of a time when man came together and formed government. Now, why are they doing that? There are no historical facts. There's no historical data that they can point to that says that this is what happened and this is how it happened. They're making it up. But what they're doing is they're making up what must have happened. What must have happened in order to account for the way government is, the kind of thing government is. More recently, anthropologists have tried to reconstruct how government first came into being. And some of them are painting a very different picture from the one painted by Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau. One of the scenarios that they describe is in the formative periods when man was divided up, there were hunters and gatherers divided up into tribes and wandering around the earth, that some men particularly violent men got together and formed bands which would go around and raid other tribes and take whatever they wanted. And they did this, they began to do this regularly, raiding regularly, and over time realized that it was easier and more efficient and more effective to stay present with those tribes and constantly take a portion of the money, portion of the produce, rather than going out on all these dangerous raiding parties. And that was the first government. It was legalized robbery. Now, if that's true, does that make any difference in the way you think about government? That's a completely different picture. It's a completely different picture because it shows a different origin and purpose for government. And that's what talking about origins usually gets down to, is why is this thing? And therefore, how did it come to be? The same is true of the origin of man and the origin of the world. The key question here is why? Why are we? Why is this? As we look at the creation story, there are a few things that we want to keep in mind, the things that are really critical to understand. The creation story can help us with these answers, with answers to these questions, but the rest of the Bible is going to have to fill this out. What kind of being is the Creator? Who is God? What is His nature? Why did He create man? What is our purpose? Why do we exist? What kind of being are we? And what provision did the Creator make for mankind? This is the starting point of the whole text of the Bible. Chapter 1 needs to give us at least some inkling as to an answer to these questions, and the rest of the Bible is going to have to fill those out. Okay, so let's look at chapter 1 then with these things in mind. I'll read the narrative for the first 6 days, and then we'll come back and talk about the features that we see here. Chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness He called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day. Then God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and there was morning a second day. Then God said, "Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear," and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters He called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind, with seed in them on the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning a third day. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He made the stars also. And God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, a fourth day. Then God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. And God created the great sea monsters, and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters of the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, a fifth day. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant-yielding seed that is on the surface of the earth, and every tree which has fruit-yielding seed. It shall be for food for you. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth which has life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw that all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. This chapter is different from the rest of Genesis in that this chapter has a very structured look to it. Every day is described in similar terms with similar elements. Every day has an announcement where it says, and God said. Then it's usually followed by a command, let there be something or other. Usually then it's followed by a fulfillment, and it was so. Usually there is also an execution, and there was X, whatever it is. Usually there's a statement of approval, and God saw it was good. And usually there is some other statement by God in which God calls something, God names something, or he blesses something. And then it concludes day, and then there was evening and morning, day, whatever. So there's clearly a very structured pattern that's being followed in this narrative. However, so it's not like historical narrative. When we get into chapter 2, it looks like historical narrative, and it follows the pattern of historical narrative right through to the end of Genesis. So it's not quite historical narrative, but it's not quite poetic language. It's not the same kind of language that you see in Psalms, where you have the couplets or three lines, which oftentimes say the same thing using different words or just slight variations on it. So this is not typical Hebrew poetry. It is not historical narrative. It's something different, something in between. It has some features of poetry, but not all of the features of poetry. Since it is so structured and patterned, it is important, I think, and I think the author intends to draw our attention to any deviations from the pattern. And so as we go through, I want to look at any of the deviations we see from the pattern that is established. Now it begins, before we get to day one and start into this pattern, we have two verses which are particularly difficult and have drawn a lot of ink from the commentators. There are several ways that the syntax in the first two sentences can be put together. But having tried all of the combinations, the way of putting it together that makes the most sense to me is the following. Throughout Genesis, there are these statements every little bit. Usually it says, these are the generations of, these are the generations of Adam, these are the generations of Noah. And apparently that is a title of a text or some body of historical material from which the stuff that follows was drawn. It has been suggested, and I think this is likely, that this first sentence in Genesis is the title of this particular section. It's sometimes called a colophon. It's like the title of a work. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth serves as a title for the material that follows. That what follows is a description of the creation of the heavens and the earth. The heavens and the earth being a figure of speech indicating all that is. That phrase, the heavens and the earth, is used elsewhere in the Bible with that meaning, and I think that's the meaning that's intended here. So in the beginning, God created everything, and that what follows is a description of that creative activity. It starts out, however, with stuff already. It starts out saying, and the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. So we're already starting out with something. So what follows is not the creation of, is not focusing on everything out of nothing. What it has chosen to focus on is the process by which God made the earth as we know it and man, the key character in the Bible. In the description of what existed prior, it is everything is formless and void. So as God begins this earth formative process, right at the very beginning, it is formless and void. There is no definition, there is no separation, nothing is distinct, nothing is clear. It's just chaos. Furthermore, there is darkness. Nothing can be seen. Nothing can be made out. Nothing can be discerned. Nothing can be distinguished. And this darkness is over the surface of the deep. The deep is a term that pops up occasionally in the Old Testament as a kind of ominous an ominous part of the earth, an ominous part of God's creation that is it is cruel and forbidding. It is not for man. It is not a place for man. It is the abode of evil and of dissolution. It is interesting to note that in Genesis 7, verse 11, when in the discussion of the flood, that not only does the rain come down, but the deep opens up to cause the floods that cover the earth. So there's something very ominous about the state of things before God begins his earth formative process. It is chaotic, formless, dark. You can't see anything. And there is nothing but the deep. There's no place for man to set his foot. It is interesting that in the ancient cultures, certainly in Mesopotamia, to a lesser extent in Egypt, well, it's true in Egypt as well, the ancient religions, their purpose was to keep back the chaos. The concept was the only way that we as human beings can survive on this earth is if the forces of nature are kept at bay, are kept within bounds, as long as they keep operating the way they ought to, because if things get out of hand, we're dead, because they will easily overwhelm us. So their religion was worship of the gods so that the gods would keep the natural forces within boundaries, keep the status quo. One of the things that happens to bring about modern science is a shift in thinking towards the perspective that nature is orderly rather than chaotic. And it was focusing on the orderliness of nature that brought about the kinds of discoveries that make modern life possible and make computers. But it's important to note that's a little bit illusory, because I think we all sense that it wouldn't take much for nature to break loose in a way that could destroy us all. I mean, you think about just thinking back in the last century, thinking back to things like the flu epidemic that swept the country in, 1918, right after World War I? Extremely deadly. And we were powerless against it. Take something like polio, which was an extremely large problem in this country in the late 40s and early 50s. Or take something like the AIDS epidemic. And think of AIDS. What if AIDS were more contagious and could be spread by sneezing or something? And we would be beside ourselves. We completely change the way we think about going out into society and all kinds of things. So the sense that nature is orderly is to a certain extent an accident of history. It could any time break loose on us in a way that we would no longer think of nature that way anymore, that we would think of nature as chaos. In any case, ancient man saw nature as at least being ominous. But the power of nature to break loose and to overwhelm man was enormous. So that's the state of things when God begins the earth formative process. Chaotic, dark, and not very hospitable towards man. However, it goes on to say in the same verse, the Spirit of God was moving or hovering over the surface of the waters. The Spirit of God was there, poised for action. So this was not going to stay this way. It was going to be transformed. It was going to be made into something different than it was. So then we get into this the process whereby God transforms this chaos into something that where man can live. Why would God do this in a process? Why didn't God snap his fingers and there's the Garden of Eden? My experience is God likes processes. There's hardly anything he does that isn't some kind of process. I have often thought, why doesn't God just snap his fingers and instantaneously make us sanctified? Wouldn't that be nice? It doesn't happen. That's not the route that God has chosen to take. The route that God has chosen to take is a much longer and more painful process. But think about the difference. How would you think differently about yourself if God instantaneously sanctified you, as opposed to bringing you through this process whereby we struggle with our own sin time after time, failing and repenting for that failure and begging God for his help and his mercy and for his strength so that we don't fail again? There's no better way than that process to help us to understand the nature of the sin that's in us. If God were to just snap his fingers, we wouldn't understand the sin in us. There's no way. So the process is extremely educative. We learn a lot through it that we would not learn otherwise. Similarly, God chose to use a process to bring about the earth, to make the earth the way it is. What's the difference? Well, if he had just snapped his fingers, it would have been easy and quick. But we wouldn't have seen the care and the thought and the thoughtfulness and therefore the love that was invested in the process to produce this thing the way it is. It's a grander and more loving God who has done this through a long, protracted process than it would have been had he snapped his fingers. Okay, why doesn't he talk about the seas, the earth covered with the seas, it coming into being? Because that's not the part that he wants to talk about. That's not the part that he wants to accentuate. What he wants to accentuate is this movement from chaos to something that's livable and orderly. So it has to start somewhere, so he starts with the chaos. That's the story that Moses wants to tell, or God wants to tell. That's what he wants to highlight. So we have nothing about the seas and the earth originally coming into being. Okay. First thing that happens when God begins then this transformation is he says, let there be light. What a bizarre place to start. I mean, if you were going to create a universe, if you were going to make the earth, what would you do first? I'm not sure that light would be the first place I'd start. It's not even starting with the sun. It's starting with light. The sun comes later. It's just light. There's no mention of the thing from which the light is emanating. There's just light. So the first thing into this dark and wet environment is light. I don't think that's an accident. The light was created first because the image is so helpful. And that is, God wanted things to be seen. He wanted to make things perceptible. His first act is to make that stuff that's out there perceptible. That's a wonderful image, because God is, right from the beginning, He wants to make things knowable. He wants to make Himself and His creation clear. He's a revealer. He wants to reveal. And as we work through Genesis, it's helpful to keep that in mind. There is a sense in which God has, right from the beginning, been reaching out to man to make Himself known to man. I really like Michelangelo's painting in the Sistine Chapel, where God is straining towards Adam, and Adam is kind of nonchalantly sitting there and raising his hand up towards God. That's a wonderful image, because there's a sense in which that's very true. God is reaching out, straining to make Himself known to us. And He starts by creating light. The first thing He does. And man throughout is strangely indifferent, actually. Okay, now let me talk about some of the features that are in this day, and then I won't repeat them with the other days. After he creates the light, He calls it good. That's something that He will do after he performs each task. He will call it good, with a couple of exceptions, and so I will only note the exceptions. Notice in this first day, however, He does not call the darkness good. He creates the light, and let's see. It says, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw that the light was good, and He separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness He called night. So He doesn't call the darkness good. He only proclaims good on the light. He separated the light and the darkness. And this is a theme that we see going throughout this narrative, is making separations and divisions. He doesn't want it all to be twilight. He wants there to be light, and He wants there to be darkness. So He makes a separation between the two. That's very important, because one of the things that, in reading Aristotle, one of the things that is striking is, He wants to take the world and divide it up. He divides everything, and he makes distinctions that I would never have dreamed of. I mean, he is very good at making distinctions. But He's trying to divide the world up, because until you make all of the meaningful distinctions, you can't understand what you've got. Let me use an illustration. Let's say I give you a bowl of stew. And I give you two bowls of stew. One has all the chunks, and the other one has been run through a blender. So it's all indistinguishable. And I asked you to describe that. You take a bite of each and describe it to someone else. The one that's been run through the blender, you're going to have a much more difficult time describing it to someone. The one that still has the chunks, you can look at the chunks and you say, well, that's carrot, that's potato, that's meat, and you can describe it that way. Aristotle's perspective is the whole world is like that. If we can just pick out the chunks and describe those, then we can get a much better handle on what the whole thing is. But if you were to give him a bowl of this pureed stew, he would have a difficult time describing it to someone. What God is doing in this creative activity is making things distinguishable, making chunks that are identifiable and definable. Okay, so he separates the light and the darkness. Then he names the light and the darkness. And what we will see as we go through here, he names in each of the first 3 days, he names things. And generally speaking, in Old Testament, if you name something, there is a sense in which you are asserting some kind of dominion over that thing, first of all. And secondly, you are assigning some kind of role to that thing. Or at least identifying the essence of that thing. So in the first 3 days, he names the things that he creates, that he brings into being. Then he concludes the day saying there was evening and morning. This is repeated at the end of each day. Why is it evening and then morning? It is our custom. See, we begin a day at midnight, so I guess we begin the day in the night and it ends in the night. But in Hebrew culture, the day began at dark, when the sun goes down, and then your next day, your day ends then with the daylight. Your day begins with the dark and ends with the daylight. God could have split up the day any way that he wanted to, but the way he prescribed to have it was to begin with the dark, end with the day. That, then, I think, captures what God is doing throughout this process. Beginning with darkness and obscurity, and working towards light and clarity, revelation. So each day then reminds us, at the end of the day, he reminds us of the direction of this pattern and what's happening. We're moving from chaos to order, from darkness to light. Now, are these days 24 hours? I don't know how we could tell. We don't even have, in day one, if we're taking this chronologically, we don't have the sun and the moon to serve as our time pieces until day four. We have light in day one, but we don't have the timepiece set up. So how would we even know in day one when the 24 hours was up? And how is a day defined at that time? That's a puzzling feature of this thing, and something that inclines me to think that the author isn't all that concerned about either chronology, nor is the author all that concerned about timekeeping. But rather, this creative activity is being divided up into six stages rather than necessarily periods of time. Okay, so that's day one. Day two, let me just point out some of the features that we see here. In day two, he makes the sky and the sea, and he does it by making a separation between the waters. So apparently then the clouds are lifted up and they become the waters up above, and the seas stay down below. And in this day, he names the sky, but he does not name the sea in this day. He ends up naming the sea in day three. And the most interesting deviation from the pattern in day two is he does not call anything good in day two. And that's an omission that we will come back to. Day three, he gathers the waters into one place and he creates the dry land. So the picture is the waters being gathered, dry land coming into being. Then, that's in the first part of day three, the second part of day three. Furnishes the dry land with vegetation. And apparently what we are to understand is that he furnishes this dry land with vegetation, and there are two categories of vegetation. There are the seed-bearing plants, and there are the fruit-bearing trees. Now, there's a phrase here that shows up for the first time, and it's going to show up several times later, and that is according to their kind. Let's see. The plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind. What does that mean? That phrase, where it's used elsewhere in the Old Testament, always seems to mean in all of its variety. Now, I know that it has become common to interpret this to mean that species produced like members of species. Species begat their own species. But that doesn't seem to be what the language is talking about. The language rather is saying it was created in all of its varieties. Every time we see that phrase used. And if you want to look, the same phrase occurs in Ezekiel 47:10. You can look at that, and that seems to be quite clearly what is meant there. It's used elsewhere also, but that's the clearest. Okay, so that's day three. Now, in day one, light was created. In day two, the waters were separated from the waters, so we have the sky and the seas created. In day three, the waters are gathered and dry land comes into being. In the second half of day three, vegetation is brought forth on the land. We're moving, apparently then, creating spaces, creating domains from far away to near with respect to man. That same pattern then is repeated in days 4, 5, and 6. In day four, he creates the lights, and those are made to separate day and night. The purpose for those lights is that they be signs, both to tell us when the fixed seasons will be and to tell us when days and years will be. So they are there for timekeepers. So this day is populating then outer space, which apparently is what it's talking about in day one, as the domain that's created. It's interesting that this day has the longest description of any of the days except for the creation of man. And apparently, that was done the only thing that I can think of and the commentators have suggested is that the author wanted to dwell upon the fact that God created all of the stars and the celestial bodies to make it clear that those are not deities, that those are in fact creations of God. So apparently some polemic against the accepted religions of the time. Day five, then, he populates first the skies with birds, and then he populates the waters. So those are the domains that he created in day two. Of note here is that it says that he creates the sea creatures. There are two words that are used throughout this narrative. One is to create and one is to make. The word create is used sparingly. And wherever the word create is used throughout the Bible, the only subject of that verb is God. He's the only one that creates. And generally, there is never something out of which he creates. There's not never a material out of which he creates. If it says that he made something out of something else, it will be a different verb. And here it says that he creates the sea creatures and the fish in the sea. So this special verb has been used in this case. Why would he use this particular verb with respect to the sea creatures? I'm not really sure, but we do have a sea creature that shows up in the Old Testament as the creature on earth that is the most powerful and the most difficult to control. And that's usually referred to as the Leviathan. And it could be that what he wants to do here is underscore the fact that even the Leviathan is a creature, something created by God. Okay, then having created the fish and the birds, he blesses them. Then day six. On day six, he populates then what he had created on day three, that is the land. He creates the animals, domesticated animals, little animals, and big wild animals. But interestingly, he doesn't bless them, and I cannot account for that. I'm not sure why. That's in the first half of day six. In the second half of day six, then, he creates man. The description of the creation of man is unique in a number of respects. The first is it starts out with, let us create man in our own image. And who's the us? Several things have been proposed, but I think the most likely is that this is what you would call a deliberative plural. We use it in English, but we use it sparingly in English. It would not be impossible for us to say, even if we were all alone, to say, let's see, what will we do next? And it's that kind of use of the plural that could be used here that could account for the language. In any case, God says, let us create man, and let us create him in our image and in our likeness. This is the only thing that God is creating in his own image, in his own likeness. And what does he mean by this? In what way is man made like God? I think the best clue to that is Genesis chapter 5, verse 3. Let me remind you where we are in the Genesis narrative when we get to chapter 5. Cain has just killed Abel and has done so in a way that was senseless. It was a senseless murder of his own brother. Then we have a description of Cain and his descendants. And everything that we read about Cain and his descendants, they were a nasty group. They were bad, bad eggs. Then Adam has another child And this child is Seth, and Seth is appointed to take the place of Abel, the brother that was killed. And so it says in Genesis 5:3, before it talks about the descendants of Adam through Seth, it says, when Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. Now, what's that talking about? Is it talking about they both had brown eyes? I mean, in what sense is Seth like Adam? In the context, appearance wouldn't make any sense. I mean, who cares what color his eyes are? What's important is that he's like Adam and he's not like Cain. In context, that's what's critical. So in other words, it is his moral likeness. These are the very same words that we have in Genesis chapter 1 when God says, let us make man in our own image and likeness. So the thing that makes most sense to me is we are made in the likeness of God in that we are moral beings. God made us to be moral beings. Now, in order to be moral beings, we had to come with certain kinds of qualities. For instance, we have to be rational. We have to be personal. We have to have self-consciousness. I mean, there are a number of things. It would make sense, though, man is creative, that he is expressive, etc., etc. There are a number of things that would make sense, that man would have these other qualities. But at the core of it, the thing that is the same between us and God is it's not power, it's not looks, but rather it's that we are moral beings. He made man then to rule over all of the animals. Then God blesses him. And he gives to him all of the plants as food. Notice he doesn't give him any meat for food. That comes later. Notice that God does not name the animals. He leaves that for man to do later. But then he says that all that he made was, God looked at all that he made and saw that it was very good. Now, there's a curious thing here. It's hard to know how much to make of it, and that is, technically, he has not separately called man good. Remember, on day two, he didn't call anything good. And here, he doesn't separately call man good, but he does say he looked at everything that he made and saw that it was very good. It's difficult to know whether we should make something of that or not. Okay, so what God has done then, what we have in chapter 1 is this description of God, the Creator, who made everything. But chapter 1 of Genesis focuses in on this transformation that he brought about and the process whereby he made this earth a place suitable for human habitation. And he takes things and he starts out with things chaotic, dark, cold, miserable, a place that no one could live and certainly would not want to live. And he transforms that step by step, starting from the distant and moving in to where man lives, with respect to domains, and then he goes back and populates them in the same order and concludes by creating man, the crowning glory of it all. So everything was prepared for man, and then man was placed there as the thing to which all of creation was working toward. Okay. There are a number of things that I want to come back in this chapter and look at in more detail next week. I also want to look at day 7 next week. So we will continue this, but I will stop here for any questions and comments.
I have a couple of questions. I think I may limit it to just one because we could be here a while. But do you think that, let's just say God. Do you think that God intended in Genesis 1 to address any or most of the questions that normally come to our mind when we think about cosmology and how all of this really happened historically? And if so, there's a lot of questions in my mind that are unanswered.
Mm-hmm.
And I have I think it's kind of natural for humans to be curious about things that the Bible probably doesn't ever address, including in this chapter. And it's okay for us to be left in the dark about certain things. I mean, obviously, that's our state. We don't know everything. And so we have to resolve that lack in our own minds. What are we going to do with that? Are we going to start speculating how tentative or confident should we be in our speculations? And the place where it seems to become relevant or more important is when we're discussing these things with other people who may not have our worldview. If you can make a question out of all that, go ahead. And I have a more focused question to ask if that's not a good enough one.
Okay. It seems to me that this account raises more questions than it answers, if that's what you're asking. I think that's absolutely true, that it is so terse that it does not give you a good picture of how all this stuff happened. And I don't think you can get a good picture for how all this stuff happened. It is aggravatingly terse. But, in fairness, if God were to explain how to create a universe, that would be a lengthy discussion, and one that we probably would not be up to anyway. And that's not what he has chosen to focus on, how to create a universe. But rather, it is what he is focusing on is why I created a universe. And his answer to that is he created the universe as a stage for human history to take place on. I think that's his primary point. But as I, the significance of day one is God is a revealer. And he made the world to be knowable. And he made us as knowers. I've I've mentioned this before, but I think it is significant that the world could have been hopelessly complicated and impossible for us to figure out. We developed a product, 13 years ago, a mixture of chocolate and hazelnuts. And we mixed it, and it worked out fine, just in small quantities, and it worked out fine. And so we had this recipe, we went into production with it, but when we made it in large quantities, we couldn't get it to turn out right. In dinky quantities, it turned out fine. In large quantities, it wouldn't work. So we contacted Oregon State and asked them, well, why won't it work? And they said, because you can't do it. And we said, well, that's hard to accept because we've done it. But we just can't do it in big quantities. So I was given the task of trying to figure out why it works in small quantities but not in big quantities. So I started to list the variables. Have you ever tried to list all of the variables that could be true of a phenomenon? Like barometric pressure, temperature, day of the week, position of the stars. Where are you going to stop? The reality could be so hopelessly complicated we could never have got to step one. It is complicated. Reality is very complicated, but it's fortunate that some of the more basic things are not that complicated. So we could ease in to some of the more complicated aspects of reality. I see that as the handwork of God. But that's the work of a creator who wants us as knowers to know. He doesn't want to make it easy, but he wants us to know. He wants us that if we work at it, there are things that we can figure out. And all of reality seems to be structured that way.
Okay, then following on that very briefly, can we believe the evidence that we see around us to the extent that it points to the process that God used to create?
In other words, can we trust the scientists and their reconstruction?
Not necessarily the scientists, but the physical evidence of creation. I'll ask the question.
Okay.
I posed this question at a conference that we had several years ago. The speaker dismissed it as silly, I think he used that word. I don't think it's silly. The question I asked, and maybe I just didn't ask it right, but would it be immoral for God to create a fossil out of nothing? Mm-hmm. And I think you can see where that leads.
Right, right.
So that's
right,
my question.
Right, right. In other words, could God have created the world in such a fashion that there is scientifically discernible data that points to a different kind of creation than actually took place? So that's your question. That's a silly question. No, I don't know. I would say that's an interesting question. It's a very interesting question. I hadn't really thought of it. I suppose that would be a little bit problematic. That God would create things in such a way that they were deceptive. However, there's a sense in which much is deceptive, at least initially, and that It takes a lot of thought and consideration of the evidence. It is often the case that evidence points in a direction for a while until something much downstream is discovered that says, "Oh no, we were hasty there." But if he actually, everything is created in such a way that it points to a different kind of creation, I think I would find that problematic. But if that's the way God wanted to do it, that's the way he did it. But I think I would find that problematic.
In verse 4, he refers to separating light from darkness. Two questions related to that. One is, do you have any idea what that means, given the fact that there's no sun or moon yet, no day or night, per se? And then, could this possibly, I mean, it doesn't seem to fit this context, but it could have possibly referred to some kind of a moral something, as in John, first chapter of John, where he refers to light and darkness.
Yeah, I'll be talking about that next week. I want to talk specifically about John 1 and how it might relate to this. I think there is a relationship. In fact, I don't know what the physical reality that's being described here would have been. It could be that it's purely metaphoric. I think that's possible. But it's also possible that there was a physical reality that came into being, light, and that was separated from the darkness. But what does that mean? It's true we don't have luminous bodies. It's hard for me to even imagine what is light without a luminous body. We don't see light without it emanating from somewhere. Can you have light? Could it have been that there was light that was not emanating from somewhere? If there was, I can't even imagine it. We don't have such a phenomenon. So presumably it was emanating from somewhere. But where, I don't know. And what does it mean to separate the light from the darkness? Maybe it was shining on the earth and behind it we have darkness. I don't really know. That's what's so difficult about this stuff, is it's so outside of our experience that the possibilities are as numerous as our imagination. But I do think that happens on day one because of its significance in the spiritual realm rather than its significance for just the physical light. Because that figure of light shining into darkness, that shows up a number of times in Scripture. Kurt?
Yeah, I've asked you this before. In 31.
Did I answer it?
I don't think so. When he says very good, I suspect it's a morally good, it's functional, and it has an aesthetic aspect as well. That seems to characterize all that God creates. What's your take on that?
Well, good is a flexible word. Good can mean a wide variety of things. And I think in this particular context, what's required is that God saw that it was the way that he wanted it. Now, whether that's perfect, morally perfect, beautiful, absolutely beautiful. I don't think those are necessarily required by the context. What's required by the context is they were the way he wanted them to be. They were to the place where he could call his creative activity with respect to that thing done. You going to ask it the next time I teach this? No, ask again, a follow-up.
Well, thanks, brother. So this is what it's like to be interviewed. No, I'll chew on that and get back to you.
Okay.
There don't seem to be a lot of details in this passage, like you mentioned, but we are inexorably drawn into the details.
Yes.
I mean, we just want to know. And I had this discussion with a friend of mine one time, and he put me to rest by saying, look, the big message in that first column in your Bible isn't the details. It is that God did it. How he did it, when he did it, all these other things are secondary to the overwhelming, obvious message that God did it. And that gave me a lot of rest. But it made me flash back on something a speaker said once. Does the entire Bible hinge, rest, is it built on the veracity of the first sentence of Genesis?
I would think so. Because if God did not create everything, it makes God a significantly different being than the rest of the Bible paints him to be. And I am... I am quite certain that when it comes down to it, the cornerstone of all human knowledge is an understanding of who God is. That if you tweak that, it has ramifications for everything else that you believe to be true. And that he created everything would be really central to who God is. Okay, we need to quit here. But save your questions. If you have questions, save them, and we'll do them next week.